Welcome to The Blast Zone, the podcast where we dig up the bombs that shook Hollywood and try to find out why they went up in flames. This week, we already covered the bad board game movie. Now it's time for a good one. This is Clue. Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Blast Zone.
Welcome to The Blast Zone.
We are not a podcast about bad movies. We are a podcast about movies that did badly. I am John Drake, in-house film critic of my Letterboxd account.
And I'm Ian Dukes. I'm a person with thoughts and feelings, and some of them are about movies.
Movies like Clue, which we'll be talking about tonight. Very exciting, very happy we get to talk about this movie that I have a lot of memories of.
But gonna figure it out.
Before we figure it out, Ian, how are you doing this week?
Oh, you know, I was feeling good yesterday. I moved to two couches and a recliner by myself, and I was very proud of my little handiwork.
That
and
is impressive.
This afternoon, I started to suspect that Mrs. Backpain hit me with a candlestick in the lumbar.
Oh, no.
It's seasoned up. If I fall off my stool during the recording, you'll know that's why. I'm fine. I just locked up. But I did a little Advil, a little electrostim, if you know what I mean. And I think I'm going to make it through.
By if you know what I mean, do you just mean you did electrostim? Because that's the case. Yeah. Then yes, I do know what you mean. If it's anything else, then I'm a little confused.
You know, the thing, you get it in the drugstore. It's a little patch with a watch battery and it zaps you.
Feels good. Like a little TENS unit?
Exactly. Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, I used to work in medical billing, so I'm familiar with those old devices. But he made me nervous. Now I'm helping my mom move next week. So now I'm starting to think I should wear one of those weird braces I always see people wearing but never understand why.
Wear the thing.
Yeah.
I wore the thing, and I bet if I hadn't, I would be really sorry. But that was just enough to keep me from being hospitalized.
I mean, I'm a little younger.
That's true, and much stronger.
I do some powerlifting in my free time.
That's got to help a little bit.
If I maintain good form while lifting the furniture, but sometimes that goes out the window when you just want to get it done so you can get to the bar.
Yeah.
So we have to do what we do every week before we get into our movie of the week and talk about our show and tell films or TV shows. So what do you got for me this week, Ian?
I got something that ties in because I'm just crafty like that, even though I did it 100% by accident. I watched Only Murders in the Building, a murder mystery Hulu original featuring Steve Martin and Martin Short and Selena Gomez.
Three friends outside of the show, I assume.
Yeah.
They were close friends for years.
Years and years.
Let's make a show together, the three of us.
Why not? We're hanging out anyway. Steve Martin co-created this thing. It's these three strangers. They live in the same swanky Upper West Side apartment complex, and they bump into each other, find out that they're all equally obsessed with true crime podcasts, and then a murder happens in their building, and they're like, oh, let's do a podcast. So you'd think I would be very sympathetic to the show about people who decide to start a podcast, and I am, but I'm not 100% sold. It's good. Martin Short is great. We love our Martin Short, Ben from Treasure Planet. He channels a little bit of that energy where
We love Ben from Treasure Planet. I never went on record that I love Martin Short, I don't believe, because he's very hit or miss for me.
All right, that's fair. Well, so he brings some Ben energy, not the crazy part, but the part where he actually plays scenes kind of straight and authentic and just does some acting. And it's nice to see that from him because, like you said, he's been known to be a little too much and a little over the top.
Yeah, I actually liked him a lot in The Morning Show because they played with that aspect of his persona a little bit, which was enjoyable. But yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, not at all. And Selena Gomez is good. I've never seen her in other stuff that she's acted in, but she's very assured and watchable as an actress. Steve Martin kind of letting me down in this. I'm not sure what to make of this.
Oh, no.
Every scene, it feels like he takes every line and does an alternate line read, so like not the obvious way to read the line the way you think the character is feeling. And it breaks up the scene because you're like, why'd he say it like that? I thought he meant this other thing. Anyway, it leaves you feeling kind of like he's searching for this character and maybe he'll find it in later episodes. I'm only a couple episodes, but it's fun. It's a mystery. It draws you in because it's a murder mystery. And then turns out the characters all have deep, dark secrets and they're going to slowly unwind over the season. So it's fun for that reason. You can easily get sucked into it and just keep on binging.
Well, that ties into today's movie in a few ways because it's a murder mystery, much like the movie we're going to be talking about. And also Martin Short and Steve Martin starred in The Three Amigos, directed by John Landis, who wrote this movie and was... he didn't write this movie. He conceived of this movie and came up with the story. But did not write the screenplay. So there's a little tie-in.
Sure.
Three Amigos, another movie I watched a lot as a kid. My dad always had the VHS around.
But, that was a fun one.
So my movie has nothing to do with what we're talking about this week. I went in a totally different direction.
Where'd you go?
I didn't have a lot of time for movie watching this week. We're recording this the Friday after the first NFL game, so I had a ton of fantasy football drafts to take care of this week, and then I had one night where I had some leisure time to watch something, and I watched Val. The Val Kilmer documentary that came out semi-recently on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. How is it? I'm scared to watch it because he's a strange person. He's in a strange state currently, and I'm not sure I want to follow him that closely, but tell me how it was.
I've always been drawn to him as an actor. There's something very charismatic and magnetic about his performances.
Yeah.
He's also a famous asshole.
Okay.
And I feel like the movie brushes over that a little too much for my liking. I'm always wary of documentaries about a subject, and that subject was either like the creative force behind the documentary
yeah.
or had, you know, some kind of oversight on it, because you're never really getting the full picture.
Sure.
He's obviously, yes, he's going through a tough time now. He can't speak normally. He has a throat apparatus that he has to use to speak, and right. it can be difficult to understand him at times. And the full movie doesn't subtitle him at all, so you kind of have to make use of context clues sometimes to really parse out what he's trying to say. His uh-huh. son Jack, which we talked about a little bit in The Nice Guys, is actually narrates as Val for a lot of the movie, and it kind of goes through the big hits of his career, the movies we all know, more obviously in the 80s and 90s than the 2000s, just because I think the type of parts he was getting in those decades are very different from each other.
Sure.
But it doesn't shy away from stuff like his reputation of being difficult on set, or the whole kerfuffle that was The Island of Dr. Moreau, okay. A future episode to be sure. But yeah, I'm always just wary of the invisible hand of this person guiding me into a narrative. Whereas if it was really made by an impartial third party, maybe we would arrive at that narrative more organically. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Do I want someone else telling my story, or do I want to produce my own documentary?
I think everyone would like the chance to tell their own story, but the problem is that story going to be impartial and objective?
Yeah. But it raises the question of like, yeah, he's a public figure. He's an artist who worked in the public sphere, but do we have the right to hear some unfiltered version of his life told by an impartial investigator?
Yeah. I mean,
just asking the big questions here on the podcast.
Legally, I suppose we do, as long as it's not, you know, liable, but
right.
Morally, is it, you know?
Yeah, can we demand that?
Okay.
I mean, it's certainly interesting when it happens.
Another interesting thing is he got really into turquoise jewelry as an older gentleman.
Oh.
He's become like a real Santa Fe bro.
Okay, that explains some of the outfits I've seen him pictured in.
Yeah, some bolo ties, some turquoise jewelry. He's really leaning into that aesthetic. But, you know, he seems happy. He seems to look back on his life wistfully and with some great admiration for the people he's worked with and the projects he's been in. He doesn't really badmouth anybody in the movie, even
That's
when
nice.
There'd be an easy chance, like with Marlon Brando, who is famously difficult on the set of The Island of Dr. Moreau, and John Frankenheimer. So he does share some behind the scenes footage he shot with his little home camcorder of him and John Frankenheimer having a pretty heated argument on the set, but it's almost presented with no context and just like draw your own conclusion.
So it's not totally sanitized. There's some
I think he was trying to give a honest and unsanitized portrayal of his life, but is that even possible? You know, can we really be objective about ourselves?
No, you probably can't. But you're saying it's not the Queen biopic. It's got a little more edge to it.
Oh, that fucking movie. Don't get me started. All right. Now let's get into it. We're talking about Clue today. Ian, I want to know, what, if any, is your history with this movie? Did you have any exposure to it before this podcast?
I had a little exposure to it. I didn't see it early on. I only became aware of it later when I watched it, because I had heard people say it was great. And I'm like, this is weird, but it's enjoyable. So yeah, I came into it positive, but you know, I'd seen it a bunch of years ago now, so I didn't remember much about it. And on rewatching this week, I'm a little torn two ways, because I'm more appreciative of actors and filmmakers. I have more understanding of the context and their bodies of work and where these people fit in. And so I'm like, oh, I'd love to see these certain faces on the screen, and they give a lot of fun performances in this movie. And then also now in my current role as a pod blaster, I'm also more demanding of stories, and I'm looking for where they do and don't work. So that always tempers my ability to enjoy these things as I might have otherwise. But yeah, I came to it not fresh, but fresh enough, because I didn't really remember it. And I had a good time, but we'll talk about where I think the movie stumbled a little bit. How about you?
Well, I did not see this movie when it was released, as I was an unborn person. I had not yet been born.
Oh yeah, hard to get to the theaters then.
Yeah, I didn't have any money or legs or any way to get around. So no, I did not go to the movie theater to see Clue. But I distinctly remember at least like 1991, when I was 5 years old, till I was like 9 years old, watching the VHS tape of Clue at least once a week.
Wow.
We didn't have a lot of tapes in my house. You'll hear me bring up like certain movies if we ever talk about them, like Short Circuit 2,
okay.
Clue, The Rookie, which was a Brendan, The Scout with Brendan Fraser and Albert Brooks. Like, I just had like a weird assortment of movies that I would kind of watch on a loop. And this was one of them. Me and my sister would watch this movie constantly.
Wow.
And I loved it. And then I just forgot about it for many years and didn't watch it again until I was putting together a list of movies for the podcast. And I was like, oh, Clue, that bombed. I was looking through lists of great movies that actually bombed, and Clue kept coming up. So I was like, yeah, absolutely, we should do an episode on Clue. And then I watched it again. And if you asked me to describe the plot, I would have just been like vague murder mystery. Uh-huh. But then 5 minutes into the movie, I remembered everything. I was like, they're going to open up this thing and the cook's going to fall out. And it's just crazy how much I must have watched it as like a 9-year-old, where it was embedded in my brain so many years later. And it hit all those same pleasure centers that it always had. And I can't really say how much of that is just based on the movie and how much of it is based on nostalgia. Who can say? If I went into this with fresh eyes and had never seen it before, if I'd be as enthusiastic about it as I am now. But no, it still works for me very much so. Like you said, it's not perfect at all. I don't want to give the impression this movie couldn't be improved in certain ways, but everyone is just having so much fun. The performances are so farcical. It feels almost like you're watching an improv troupe, but like a good one, which is rare.
Yeah.
So that's like the vibe I get from this movie.
It's a great set of comedy actors, and they do the most with the silly gags that they have to pull off. And it's fun.
Yeah, there's just little things they do, and we'll talk about them as they come up that make me laugh every time. There's other parts where the movie veers into physical comedy in a way that I didn't appreciate as much.
Okay.
Like there are literal Three Stooges sound effects at some points when somebody like stomps on a foot and gets poked in the eyes. And I was like, that's kind of silly. We're still talking about murder, right?
Yeah.
We're kind of trying to be serious, but you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves now. I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it because it's fun that we're coming in with different perspectives. I get to see it a little bit through your eyes, which is that childlike appreciation. And I can totally see why at that age, the things that this movie lacks are the things that a kid would not even be looking for in the movie. So you can just have a ton of fun with it.
And the things this movie has are things that a young boy would be looking for in abundance. And I'm talking about cleavage, you guys. There's a lot of boobs in this movie.
Yep.
Colleen Camp was very integral to my development as a young man. So
I can only imagine. As I like to say, they should have called this movie Cleavage because, man, they just love those stresses and having the women bend over and pick things up.
And they don't give the ladies anything. You know, Mr. Body doesn't show up in a tank top or anything. Like, there's no equivalent.
No.
There's no eye candy in the dude department here unless you're
not
big.
Really.
Like, you know, Michael McKean's rocking his suit very well.
Yeah.
It seems, you know, well-tailored, but that's not going to click the same buttons. So should we talk about the movie, how it got made and how it was conceived? Because it's kind of a weird idea for a movie, especially in the 80s.
That sounds fun. Let's hear how this thing happened.
All right. So these days, movie fans have a lot of complaints about the fact that everything is based on some kind of pre-existing IP. We already ranted for an hour on this very podcast about how dumb it was to make a movie about the board game Battleship.
Yeah, we talked about that once before.
Hit. But in the early 80s, writer and director John Landis had the idea to turn the board game Clue into a murder mystery slash comedy film. Landis approached playwright and screenwriter Tom Stoppard to write the film, but after a year of trying to crack it, Stoppard gave up and returned all the money.
After all that time, he didn't have a clue.
Landis then considered composer Stephen Sondheim and actor Anthony Perkins to write the script, but they ended up being too expensive. Eventually, Jonathan Lynn, who had been tapped to direct the movie, ended up writing the screenplay as well. A who's who of comedy stars at the time were cast in the movie, including Tim Curry, Christopher Lloyd, Michael McKean, Eileen Brennan, and even Carrie Fisher. Just before filming, Fisher had to drop out of the project and was replaced by producer John Peters' wife, Leslie Ann Warren. Landis had dreamt up an interesting idea for the movie. Multiple endings would be shot and play randomly at different showings. So if you saw the movie at one theater on Saturday night, you might see the ending where Mrs. Peacock is revealed as the villain. Go to a different theater on a Monday afternoon for a matinee and you may find out that Wadsworth is the bad guy of the story.
You might even learn that you wasted your money.
Filmed between November 15th and December 13th of 1984, the movie used the famed Max Busch House in Pasadena for its exterior house and ballroom scenes and built a mansion set for the rest of the shots. Released on December 13th, 1985 to mixed reviews, the multiple endings gimmick failed to attract audiences to the theater as the movie would go on to make $14.6 million against a $15 million budget. Once the home video release hit, however, the film would amass a massive cult following and is now considered one of the beloved comedies of the 80s.
I love this fact in there that they tried to write, like, we've got to write a board game movie. And all these people were trying and failing.
Just years of development for a movie about Clue. I guess as far as board games go, Clue is more tailored for a feature film than most, right? It's a murder mystery. There's a cast of characters already. There's iconic weaponry that you can use that comes up in the game.
Yeah, certainly the whodunit is a tried and true movie genre. And so you can see the reasoning. So like, I get why you would take a chance on this and go, oh, we got two angles. We can do a whodunit, which we might have been able to get greenlit anyway. And it's this beloved family board game. So maybe we'll get some families out.
Not much of a family movie, though, even though I watched it as a kid a lot, which probably wasn't great because, yeah, the movie's pretty. First of all, it's talking about like the communist scare in Hollywood at the time. Well, not in Hollywood, but, you know, in the 50s. That's like a major plot point in the movie.
It's sort of tacked on there. Oh, we should have a theme. We should make this more than just this shallow board game thing. Let's tack in a theme, Red Scare. Add some meaning. Otherwise, that's a bunch of people and it's just their little personal foibles.
It's one of the only things that kind of dates the movie in like a time and place. I know it takes place in 1954, but you wouldn't know outside of a few throwaway lines. And, you know, Colonel Mustard makes his money during the war. But right. In 84, that could have been Vietnam, could have been, you know, like there's a few throwaway lines that give you an idea of when the movie's supposed to take place. But the communism thing is really the only thing that I felt really. And J. Edgar Hoover being on the phone at some point.
Yeah, that's a weird little plot point.
That was one thing I could not have remembered. I was like, J. Edgar Hoover?
Yeah, that's like a throwaway thing that's, I guess, ties into that bigger theme of the FBI and the fact that some of these people are tied into certain kinds of spying, depending on which ending of the movie. Oh man, this movie, when you get into the plot logic and those details, it quickly bogs down because you have all this complicated murder mystery, double meaning stuff, and you have to try to square it up against three different endings, which is kind of impossible to do.
Yeah, I think it does an admirable job of trying to tie up its loose ends and make most things make sense. There was a couple times during my first watch, I would remember something and be like, oh, I guess that's a plot hole. But then I was determined to find time for a rewatch of this one because I feel like this one really deserves a rewatch.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, no, they do answer that question. You know, it's handled quickly and maybe thrown away a little bit, kind of brushed over. But they at least try to address, I think, most of the plot holes they would have had otherwise.
I think you're right. I had that same experience. I'm like, wait, that can't be right. There's no good explanation for that. And I'm like, oh, you know what? So they made a very earnest effort to actually tie up all the loose ends, make everything fit, even with three endings, which is super hard to have the same set of actions justify three different killers and different motivations. It's a real challenge. It's just that for me, there ends up not being enough stakes personally because of the ensemble nature of it. There's no single real hero. And just because of the tone of the movie, you know, so much of the comedy is on the edge of absurdity. So like the characters aren't that real. Their dilemmas aren't that real. So there's no stakes. You don't feel that invested in really solving the murder outside of a mystery game reason to do it. It's like, oh, it's a puzzle and my brain wants to solve it. But it's not like, oh my God, I hope our hero overcomes this issue and works out the killer because there's a reason. There's not really a reason.
Right. And I think the best way to watch this movie, if you want to be pleased, if you just want to watch a movie and have fun and walk away from it feeling like you had a good time, is to just watch it in the moment and don't try to consider the overarching plot or storyline and just kind of soak up the performances and the individual little scenes and line readings that are handled so well. Because, yeah, it doesn't really work as a serious movie when you start to pull out the seams.
Yeah, and it's not trying to be. And like, yeah, I did some research just on what's the right term to call this film. The term screwball comedy came to mind, and I looked up what that is. It's almost a fit for this. Screwball comedies are actually specifically in their origin are a set of comedies that are more like romantic comedies where they had to take the sexual innuendo out or the actual love scenes out because of the censorship rules in that era of filmmaking, and they replaced them with this sort of heightened comedy where they only hint at it. And so this movie has some of that. There are scenes of sexual tension between the men and the women, and it gets conducted with outrageous jokes and this fast-paced repartee and silly wordplay jokes and a lot of physical humor. But yeah, the jokes are heightened above the level of the reality, so there's very serious situations that are mostly played for laughs.
I would say it's a farce is how I would describe it.
Yeah, farce is, I think, is the perfect word or the best fit for this. And so, yeah, if you go in ready to take on a farce, yeah, you don't scrutinize the plot too hard on a farce, even though when you have a really well done one, it also gives you a fun, satisfying, logical plot. This one pretty much pulls off, except that it strains your ability to enjoy it if you only saw one ending. And maybe we'll come back around to that discussion towards the end.
Yeah, since neither of us ever saw this in theaters and had to deal with that scenario, I wonder what it would be like and if we'd have different feelings about it. Because, yeah, I feel like the movie works much better as this silly three-ending film. That's part of the gimmick. Mm-hmm. If you just seen it as a linear movie with one of those three endings, I don't know that any one of them is strong enough to really justify everything that came before it.
It's not as much payoff because the setup really is in the puzzles and the intricacy. And, you know, for me, I want to feel feelings in a movie, even a farce. And this movie just kind of doesn't have that. I was looking for a hero. You might think after the first few minutes of the movie that the butler Wadsworth is going to be the hero. He's the first guy you see, opens on him. He has a perfect save the cat scene, what you might call that in screenwriting parlance. He does something that's clever and resourceful at the top. He meets these loud barking dogs that are guarding the house, and he comes equipped with bones to give them, and he cleverly shortens their chains so that they will no longer be a threat. And you're like, okay, this guy has got it together. He's my dude. And then he immediately steps in dog shit and it tears him back down right straight to low status, because then every other person that arrives makes a face smelling the shit that he didn't manage to get off his shoes. And now he's just an asshole again.
Right. And I'm sure that was like some attempt at a metaphor, but I don't know. The dog shit joke didn't land for me. We should get through the first part of the plot and then we can talk more about it a little bit. Do you want to walk us through that first section?
Sure. Let me jump into the plot. So on a dark and stormy night, six strangers arrive for dinner at a spooky mansion at the invitation of the mysterious Mr. Body. Wadsworth the butler greets them and assigns each of them a color-themed pseudonym to keep their identity secret. As they chat, the guests start to suspect that they're connected when Mr. Body arrives and reveals his evil plan. He's been blackmailing each of the guests over their darkest secrets, and now he's locked them in the house together. Mr. Body hands them all weapons and says if they want to escape and keep their sins secret, one of them must kill Wadsworth. Then he switches off the lights. When the lights come back on, it is Mr. Body who is dead on the floor.
When you lay it all out like that, this is a pretty silly premise for a movie.
Yeah, but I come in with kind of an appreciation for that kind of murder mystery. They call it the country house whodunit, or it's got different names still going on. I think you and I both loved Knives Out because it has that same kind of thing. A bunch of people in a house and a murder and detective.
Knives Out, clearly inspired by Clue to some degree.
Yeah, I'm sure. Rian Johnson, though, is a master at writing that stuff. He's on a level that these guys, you know, they worked hard, but that movie works as a comedy, but also an amazing mystery,
right?
An engaging story.
Well, it's kind of like you mentioned, if you want to do this multiple ending thing and have each ending make sense on its own terms, you probably have to do a lot of reverse engineering of the plot to make sure I didn't do anything earlier that would somehow negate what I'm trying to do in this ending where Mrs. Peacock is the villain, but also in this ending where Wadsworth is the villain. You know,
yeah.
I feel like it almost ends up diluting the story of the whole movie because you probably are like, oh, I can't do that now because that would somehow negate a point I was trying to make in the ending where Miss Scarlet's the bad guy, you know?
Right.
There's just a lot of heavy lifting you have to do to make three separate endings with wildly different tones work for one main movie.
Yeah, in the final and what they call in the home video release the authentic ending, Michael McKean's character is the hero, and wouldn't it have been cool if he could have been the hero throughout or could have been some form of the hero, but he's just a minor side character throughout because you have to keep all the doors open and all the options open.
He might be the most virtuous of all the characters throughout the entire movie just because like his secret isn't about something terrible he's done. You know, it's
right.
Just about his sexual orientation. So therefore, not even that all the secrets are necessarily something terrible, but his is the least bad. He's keeping it a secret just to keep his job. There's really
right.
No like...
He has not murdered anyone. He has not profited off of other people's misery. Like some of these people have done some bad stuff and it comes out.
Right. He's literally being blackmailed just to keep his private life private. So it's easy to relate to him and feel a little bit of empathy for him out of all the characters.
That's true. I mean, they had to leave him open to become, right? If they had given him something really dark, it would have been weird to announce that he's the FBI man in the end.
But his performance is a lot of fun. His little, he spills drinks on people and he's very jumpy, very anxious.
Yeah, exactly. He calls himself accident prone. He sits on tables and they come crashing down. He's spilling drinks. And I love Michael McKean. We just did Spinal Tap and he's iconic in that role. And of course, like for me being super old, I first met him in Laverne and Shirley when Lenny and Squiggy would make guest appearances and then went on to have their own spinoff show. So I know him in a couple really iconic things, but to see him in a thing where he's has a different look and he's still a young man and he's playing a role, it's so fun for me. I just really like him.
Yeah. And think about the differences in his character in this movie and Spinal Tap, which were only a year apart.
Yeah.
Like the range is just enormous. And
yeah.
The more I go back and kind of watch these old performances of him, because obviously, you know, I know him from more contemporary stuff and like Better Call Saul. He was really impressive. I'm just gaining so much more respect for him as a comedic actor and just an actor in general by being able to go back and revisit these earlier roles of his.
Yeah. And despite doing all these iconic things, he seems like he runs in this second tier where he's less visible, or he's like, he's not a first call name when you think of comedic icon actors of this era.
I think he's a step above a that guy, but he's a step below an A-list comedian.
Yeah.
He's right there in the middle ground, which, you know, to be honest, maybe that's probably the most desirable level of celebrity to have, right? You could probably walk down the street without getting harassed, but you're still pretty rich.
Still go to dinner. I'm sure he gets all kind of Spinal Tap lines yelled at him wherever he's gone for the last 30 years.
That's true. That's a good point. Gets old after a while, I'm sure.
It's fun, though. We wouldn't turn it down if we had the chance.
And so we got to talk about Tim Curry. We're talking about iconic actors of the 80s. Yep. Tim Curry is just one of the titans of cinema from that era, comedy or otherwise. He's got so many roles under his belt. I just trust him immediately when I see him in a movie, though. So that works against Wadsworth in this movie for me, just because the roles I know Tim Curry for are pretty villainous.
So, I mean, he wasn't wearing fishnet stockings and he didn't have giant devil horns coming out of his head. So I'm like, oh, this must be a good Tim Curry. I was okay with him. But
well, he plays not a butler, but a hotel attendant in Home Alone 2.
Okay.
And he's pretty evil in that one as well.
Okay, well, see, yeah, that's...
Because he has the nerve to not want, like, an 8-year-old kid, like, just fucking running amok in his hotel. The absolute nerve.
Yeah, the gall.
And then, of course, he was Pennywise, which is its own whole thing of why I'm scared of Tim Curry.
That is a really good reason, and I somehow repressed that. I was probably so frightened by that, even though you reminded me about it a few days ago. It again slipped my mind right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's in a lot of makeup, obviously. He's playing a clown, but it's still undeniably Tim Curry. And, yeah, Tim Curry rules. Let's just get that out of the way. We have the utmost admiration for him.
And he's like an internet favorite. He is a cool people pop culture favorite. I feel like he himself alone is a big reason for the cult status of this movie. Do you like it's a Tim Curry movie where you get to see him just go nuts and have fun?
Yeah, he's chewing up the scenery, having a blast. And I definitely could see that. That makes a lot of sense as far as why people got into this movie so late. People got into Tim Curry and just kind of went back through his catalog. And were like, oh, wait, this one's kind of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have a time machine to go back and see if that's actually why this movie got more popular, but it's a solid theory.
We're just speculating here. So speaking of classic comedy actors, I mean, it's a great lineup. Iconic actors of the 80s and also featuring the lead singer of Fear.
Yeah.
Interesting choice.
Mr. Body, played by Lee Ving from Fear.
I almost just busted out my Lee Ving impression. I don't care about you. I don't know. That was like a song that was stuck in my head from the 80s.
Yeah. Are you a Fearhead?
I'm not, but I somehow glommed onto him and watching him in what was the Penelope Spheris documentary about the punk era, Decline of Western Civilization.
Yeah, the first one.
Yeah. He's in that, right? I think that's where I knew
him. Because that one was punk. The second one was metal. Okay. But yeah, he was a big part of that documentary. Really interesting movie. I kind of want to go back and rewatch it.
I do too. I had some personal connection because I was in the band around that time. And we actually played in Club 88 and with a really weird, kooky owner of Club 88 who personally told us the rules for playing his club. He's also in that documentary explaining the pogo as an up and down gyration in a vertical position. That line still stuck with me.
Your life gets more interesting every day. Every time we record an episode, I find out a tidbit to just
throw these weird little things. It's interesting to me because these tidbits lie dormant in my brain and I never think of them until I see Lee Ving in a funny movie.
Lee Ving pops up in an 80s comedy. Why do you think he was cast in this movie? Is there any? I couldn't find anything specific about, like, why was Lee Ving in this movie?
I don't know. He's interesting. He's not a great actor, but he has a good look.
He's not a great actor. No, he looks the part of a sleazeball power broker type dude.
Yeah.
I don't think he's up to snuff with the actors in this movie.
So yeah, what is this thing? I feel like I can see it, and I've seen it in myself. When there's someone on camera who's not a real actor and not comfortable on camera, they're not looking at the camera, but it feels like they're looking at the camera when
they're
aware
of the camera.
They're
every time.
So like, aware of the camera. Like, how can you see that? They're not literally ever glancing at it, but why are human beings able to perceive this very subtle thing? Like, you feel it's really strongly, right?
I feel it even more so because the character he's trying to play is so unbothered and he feels like he has all the power. But meanwhile, you can just tell the actor is having a low-key anxiety attack. So it just really is a juxtaposition that just jumps out at you a little bit. And I would not have been able to express what it was about his performance that felt off, but I think you nailed it. Like, he's trying not to look at the camera.
Yeah, it's so weird. Humans are incredibly perceptive at stuff that we can't even describe and we couldn't point it out, you know.
Maybe there's a German word for this. I don't know.
There probably
is. There's
not
an English one for it, as far as I know. But yeah, you could see, like, he's low-key anxious. He doesn't ruin the movie by any means. He just kind of sticks out a little bit in some of these big ensemble scenes because he's dealing with, you know, you're acting across from Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah.
You're going to be outclassed if you're not a real actor.
Yeah, you feel for him. Like, he tries and he pulls certain things off well, and he's got a good look and he's got a sound and an attitude. And it's fine. It's a fun casting. It seems like he tried to get into acting as his punk rock career wound down, and somehow he had a good agent or he was friends with some of these people, and good for him.
Yeah, he had a couple movies in this era, but none of them probably as big a role as Mr. Body or in as such a major a production.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's not glaringly bad, but he does kind of stand out a little bit.
So speaking of him as Mr. Body, he's in a confusing role because if you follow the plot of the movie, it flips back and forth who he is. Is he actually Mr. Body? Is he not?
Is he the butler?
Is he the butler? Is he a victim of this scheme? Is he the mastermind of this scheme? It flips back and forth. We talked about trying to follow the plot. There's a point where Mr. Body learns in air quotes that they're locked in because we heard him in the hallway talking to Wadsworth. I'm locking the door now. And yet then a minute later, he's in the room with them and learns that they're all locked in together. He freaks out, says, "You can't keep me here. I'm busting out." He makes a run for it. And you could see if he was doing that to throw the rest of them off, why he would make a scene like that in front of them. Then he runs into the weird garden greenhouse room that's all glassed in, and he's alone in there with Wadsworth, and he freaks out even more. Like, he doesn't drop his
act. In the Northeast, we call those a three-season room.
Oh, okay.
That's... you can't go in it during the winter.
Ah, I didn't know that term. That makes sense. And yeah, he's about to throw something through the window and break out, and a big Doberman scares him off. And at that point, like, Wadsworth is the evil. He's acting like an evil mastermind.
How many fucking dogs are on this property, by the way? Yeah, this is not the German Shepherds we saw in the beginning. It's a different dog.
It's a different dog. This one had not been appeased with a giant bone. He's hungry and he's mad.
Yeah. I can't really think of any good reason for why he would be maintaining the illusion when it's just him and Wadsworth there.
Except in the final plot, is he the victim? Is the butler forced to play the role of mastermind? And so this is where...
Yes, when Wadsworth is the villain, Mr. Body is actually his butler who's been tasked with playing out this whole scheme.
Okay, so then that does make sense. Then that's an unguarded moment where he's like, I thought I could go along with this, but now I see I'm going to get killed. I got to get out of here.
And well, when he does ask Wadsworth to open the door, did you catch the wordplay there? Wadsworth says, "Over my dead body."
Oh.
And he's Mr. Body. And then shortly thereafter,
he becomes dead. Mr. Dead Body. Yes, he certainly does.
Oh, wordplay. It's screenwriting, baby.
There's so much wordplay. Martin Mull's character is all about just misunderstanding words with double meanings and confusing sentences in this incredibly obtuse, absurd way. And it's fun because Martin Mull is a really fun actor.
Playing Colonel Mustard, by the way.
Colonel Mustard, but it's so silly.
Yeah, he's like the punching bag of the movie, which I thought he played well.
He's good at that.
Just a man constantly butting up against the upper limits of his intelligence, trying to like figure a way out of this or at least figure out what's going on.
Yeah. And Tim Curry's Wadsworth tortures him with his cold comebacks and confuses him further and further on purpose.
I did like when he says, "I'm the butler." Well, what do you do? I buttle. I'd never heard of that. I enjoyed it.
Is that real? That's the kind of word that you would take as a kid. And that's latch a fun kind of wordplay that you could tell your friends that joke on the schoolyard.
Probably did. Can't remember. It was a long time. And
I would have.
Several drugs ago.
Yeah.
All right. You want to move on to the middle portion of the movie?
Yeah. Let's hear what happens next.
All right. So Wadsworth confesses it was actually him that sent the letters. He too had been a victim of Mr. Body, and he brought them all there to confront Body and turn him over to the police. They now have 39 minutes to figure out who killed Body before the police arrive. They run to check on the cook, but find her dead too. Body's body goes missing from the study, but he turns up dead again in the powder room. A stranded motorist appears at the front door and asks to use the phone. They lock him in the lounge with the phone and then split up into pairs to search different rooms in case there is someone else lurking in the house. They locate several hidden passageways between rooms. But while they search, someone sneaks into the lounge and kills the motorist. Then an off-duty cop rings the doorbell to investigate the broken-down car he saw outside. They hide the bodies from him and resume searching, but all the lights go out, and before they get turned back on, there are three more murders. The cop, the maid-y vet, and a singing telegram girl who showed up at the front door.
It really picks up pace here.
It's people start dying like this is a horror movie.
Yeah, it starts to go real fast, which is a sign of good writing that you shorten the time between beats as you go on so it doesn't get too drawn out. But there's a fair amount of drawing out. We condensed it pretty tight in that little synopsis, but there is a lot of scenes of people splitting up and very tentatively deciding whether they're going to go into the room that they're supposed to go into and doing some you first, no you, and squeezing past each other.
Right. Nobody wants to be in front because they don't trust the person behind them.
Right.
They draw matches to pair up. I wouldn't say it drags because even with three endings, it's still a pretty tight movie. It's like 94 minutes or something.
That's very fair.
But it does feel like it goes on for a little bit, maybe a click too long of people just kind of feeling around in the dark.
I think it's that maybe it starts to feel repetitive, even from one scene to next. Like two of them are in a dark basement, two of them are in a dark upstairs room, and you're like, okay, it's a lot of dark rooms. These bits of action don't feel all that different. And then they do the whole thing twice, right? They discover a secret passage twice. Mm-hmm. They lock a guy in a room who gets killed, and then another guy shows up. Then they lock him in a room, and then they go back to searching. They literally go, okay, now he's locked in the room. We have to go back to the same rooms we were just searching and do that again.
Is getting stuck in a room part of Clue the game? I haven't played it in a long time. Can you like get stuck in a room where you can't leave?
Well, it's about rolling your dice and having enough moves to get from room to room. So it's about okay. Like how quickly can you get, because each time you go into a room, you get a clue. I guess you get a card that tells you something about what, who is, or
this
who
is a podcast where we describe the rules of board games now.
I'm doing this from memory, man. It's been 20 years since I've tried to play Clue, but like this is the part where this is the payoff. If you are here to see a board game being played, this is the part. You've got characters, they're walking from room to room, they're picking up clues, and each one of them has an actual crime to solve. So that's what's unique about this board game, is like you're one of the characters and your job is to walk from room to room, pick up clues, and anyone else could be the murderer. And so you get to try to figure that out. So I don't know, credit to them for actually figuring out how to make that mechanic work and translate it to the middle section of a film.
It doesn't feel as labored as, and I'm sorry to bring up a Battleship again, no, but you know, it's going to happen. There's not that many movies out there based on board games that bombed at the box office. But like the scene where they're trying to blow up the other ship and they're basically playing Battleship by using death charges, that felt like a labored attempt to work the mechanics of the board game into the film. Whereas this feels a little more organic, and I didn't really know that I was being pushed in that direction until like I started examining it a little deeper.
Yeah, because you're already there. It's like natural to be in a mansion with different rooms and look for clues when you're in a murder mystery, but like it's not natural to pull up a grid. That was much more of a groaner in Battleship when you're like, oh my God, they're playing
like
Battleship.
Everything in Battleship.
They're calling out coordinates. There was no actual flipping of cards or rolling of dice in this one. Although they did get handed out the murder weapons, which was cool. That to me, if there's
good
any
scene.
Payoff. Yeah, if there's any payoff for turn the board game into a movie, it's to show me the cool game pieces. If you did a Monopoly movie, I want to see the fucking dog in the wheelbarrow made out of pewter.
I did think it was odd because Miss Scarlet is the first. First of all, I have two things about the gift opening scene, which I appreciate you bringing that up because I have some qualms. Qualm number one, that fucking briefcase was not big enough for all those packages.
Oh, shit.
Is that like a clown car of a briefcase? What the fuck is going on? He's got like 8 boxes in there and they're all at least like shoebox sized.
The shoebox are bigger.
In one little briefcase. I was like, there's no way. So that's qualm number one.
Okay, that's fair.
Qualm number two, Miss Scarlet is the first one to open her gift and she gets a candlestick, but then she's like all nervous. Like there's something sinister about it. Like a candlestick is a pretty nice gift on its own. There's no reason.
Kind of a nice gift. Yeah.
Yeah. Why are you assuming it's bad? I understand. When people start getting knives and guns and like a noose, you're like, all right, something weird is going on. But if I just opened a candlestick, I'd be like, gee, thanks, Mr. Body. This is pretty nice. All right. Those are my qualms about the gift scene.
But those are good qualms. I put my stamp of approval on your qualms.
Appreciate it.
I did not realize that about the suitcase being a clown suitcase, but
I rewound it to make sure he didn't bring the suitcase, but also another little like Santa sack.
Exactly. But I was about to say Santa. Yeah. He would have had to have a big old pack on his back.
Nope. Just one regular size briefcase. Maybe if you gave them all documents, I could see it.
Card like with the
right a picture of the weapon on. So this section of the movie also does this weird thing where Mrs. White and Yvette both have weird monologues to somebody that we can't see. Yvette's in particular, she drops the French accent and starts just monologuing.
Oh yeah, before she gets strangled.
I'm glad she drops the French accent because then at least we can be like, all right, that accent was, you know, not
it was just
real.
Corny fake, yeah.
She's acting too. Yvette is acting.
Right. In the part of a French maid.
That makes that accent a lot easier to swallow.
Yeah, the monologues are weird. Doesn't the cop also do a monologue right before he's killed? Or he's on the phone, but he's not
just
monologuing.
He's on the phone. Yeah, like you get the sense that the person on the other line is half listening to him because he's just going on.
Yeah, he's kind of rambling.
There's a lot of that. Even the motorists. I'm at this big house and they're having
a party.
True. And my boss happens to, like my old boss from back in the whack. Like everyone's, it's just, it's a plot device they go back to a little too much.
They lean on that. They're like, oh man, we didn't have time to flesh out these characters. Let's have them say something portentous right before they're murdered. And it works. It's pretty mechanical. In this part of the movie, this is the board game part. And we're like, we're rolling dice. We're moving the pieces. We are cranking it out. Because we got to get 6 people into this house who are not the main characters, right? Because unlike...
And we got to kill them.
Yeah, we got to get them killed. Like unlike other murder mysteries, you can introduce like a bunch of interesting characters and then you can kill off a couple of them during the mystery and it gets scarier. Because you're like, oh, that guy, I had just gotten to know him and he died. But you can't do that with any of the mains. in this because they all have to be there at the end to point the fingers.
They all have to be suspects, yeah. I mean, the movie almost makes a joke out of it that like anybody who's not one of our main cast is definitely going to get murdered when the guy who ends up being the FBI agent rings the doorbell and starts talking about the kingdom of heaven. And yeah. Mrs. Peacock is like, whoever it is, they got to get out of here. They're going to get killed.
Yeah, they acknowledge it in a funny way because it's this damn country house in the middle of nowhere on a stormy night. Man, the doorbell sure rings a lot. I would be so unhappy living at this place.
The singing telegram girl played by Jane Wheedlin, who was the guitarist for the Go-Go's.
That was a cute little cameo. Very quick cameo.
Yeah, she doesn't get to do much.
She says two words and then blam.
Do you think like the Go-Go's and Fear played on a couple double bills? I can't really see that.
They're not totally compatible as bands, but yeah, they're, I don't know.
They probably partied equally as hard though. Belinda Carlisle was...
They probably saw each other, yeah, around Hollywood music parties, but they're just scooping up all the little parts in this movie and getting killed left and right.
What else from this scene should we talk about? Okay, they find out the cops are on their way. They have 39 minutes, but then they continue going down this rabbit hole of murder and exploration and mystery. I know you were confused in this section about why they wouldn't just wait for the police to show up, right? Just kind of hunker down in a room and wait for it to blow over.
Yeah, it doesn't take any of them time to figure out why they need to do stuff, but it took me time because they're all looking at each other like, we can't let the police come because something bad will happen. And I guess the something bad is that the police will ask them questions and their secrets will come out that they've been being blackmailed for. Does that sound like the reason? Because otherwise it's like, there's a killer in this house.
That's the most we're going to get as far as an explanation for why they wouldn't.
But like, if they find the killer, what would they imagine they do? Catch them, tie them up. The police are still going to come. You think the police are not going to ask questions at that point? There's like dead bodies and a guy that's tied up and these people are telling you he's the killer. Like, and whoever you are, sir, you're free to go home. And
yeah, calling the cops in general just kind of puts a clock on the whole thing. If the cops weren't on their way, they could have found the killer, interrogated him, killed him, put him in the cellar, like they were planning to do with the other dead bodies and just kind of being on their way.
Which they do in a couple of the endings say, let's do that. You know what? The cops aren't actually coming. That was my little ruse. And they're like, let's just leave the bodies here, which again is preposterous. Like somebody owns that house. Someone knew they were coming.
Anyway. Unless you're going to, you know, put them in the wall like a fucking Edgar Allan Poe story. Yeah, you got to do something. You can't put them in the cellar.
It's going to get dark.
Oh, God. I forgot about that. That scene in Sicario is so fucked up.
It's awful. This movie is slightly less dark than Sicario, if anyone was wondering whether they were ready for it.
They don't actually do the Sicario bodies in the wall moment. God, that house must have smelled terrible. All right. So I did have a personal anecdote that I needed to share, and it has to do with when they're exploring the house and Colonel Mustard opens the ironing board door and the ironing board comes out and hits him in the forehead. And he's like, oh, that actually happened to me at an Airbnb once, staying in like a very old house, obviously, because that's not really a thing that houses have these days, which is probably why I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, it's funny.
It was not funny. I was bleeding.
Oh, shit. Oh, sorry for laughing then.
No, it's worth laughing. I would bring it up, you know, on a comedy podcast. So I'm expecting people to laugh at me, but I probably needed stitches. My pride wouldn't let me go get them.
Oh,
but
man.
Yeah, that shit hurt. I had a knot on my forehead for a week.
Oh, man, people. At least put a soft cover on your ironing board if you're going to hide it in a secret door.
It was like the underside got me.
Yeah.
Boom.
Which has got metal that sliding underside. Ridge and the lever.
Yeah. Not great. Didn't feel good. Just like our old guest, Nash Flynn, actually stepped on a rake once and it was like, it was not comedic. It hurt a lot. This is the same thing.
Yeah.
The ironing board scene.
Those old cartoon gags are not so funny when they hit you.
Not so funny. You're flesh and bone. So if you stay at an old house you're not familiar with and you see an oddly shaped little pantry door, just open it with caution. Be careful, guys.
Nice and slow.
Keep a hand up just in case. What else from the section do you want to talk about? Are you ready to move on to the ending?
I think we can move on.
All right. Bring us home, Ian.
All right. So Wadsworth and the six guests have survived, but there have now been a total of six murders, one with each of the six weapons body handed out. Wadsworth says he now knows who did the murders and how, and he leads everyone around the house in a fast-paced retelling of the story. He reveals the guests' secrets and identifies the multiple killers and their motivations. Then there's a freeze frame, and he does it two more times. In each of the three endings, the police rush in and justice is done. But in the third and supposedly real ending, Wadsworth admits he's the real Mr. Body, and he and five of the guests are each responsible for one of the six murders, all except for Mr. Green, who's actually an FBI agent who's been working the case from the inside.
So my inherent distrust of Tim Curry is proven correct because the ending that we're supposed to accept as canon has Wadsworth being Mr. Body, being the real villain, villain of the movie. Well, I guess all the characters except Mr. Green are villains at that point, but just to different degrees. He's a mastermind of it all.
You were right to not trust Tim Curry.
Well, he was like the Gary Oldman of his time. You know, Gary Oldman went through a string of just playing nothing but heinous villains for 15 years. So Tim Curry just was like the early version of that. He made his bones playing evil people.
Yeah, for sure. So he was great at it.
He was great at it. I mean, he's great at everything. We love Tim Curry. I can't stress that enough. So the movie ends. It is kind of hard to feel any kind of like emotional release when a movie has three endings, you know, and they're all kind of played for laughs more than anything.
And it's got those little silent movie style title cards. This is what might have happened. And it gets real slapsticky at that end with Tim Curry just hightailing it around the house and everyone following him room to room as he literally sprints around the house telling the story at high speed.
He has a lot of fun with it. It's a very silly little sequence, but there's a lot of good laugh out loud moments, in particular his Michael McKean impression when he does the Mr. Green impression after slapping Mrs. Peacock. I had to stop her from screaming. Like, he does the face and everything. It's very good. It's worth it.
I think I was perturbed by the slapping and it didn't sink in how good that impression was.
Just the needlessness of it.
Like, yeah, there was. Nowadays, I think people don't do slap in the face comedy, thankfully, especially involving women, as like a throwaway funny thing that you can just do as a haha gag anymore. So when I see it in older movies, I get a little bit thrown for a loop for a second. And so I think that's where my mind was, but it does not take away from Tim Curry's excellent performance.
Yeah, it is a little jarring, just the violence being played so humorously in the movie, but it worked. It was of its time.
Yeah.
But definitely the times have changed in regards to that.
Yes, thankfully so.
So let's talk about the gimmick of the three endings a little bit. What did you think of it? How would you have felt going to a movie theater and seeing only one of them? Would it feel more like a real movie, or do you think the endings themselves are just unsatisfying on their own and it kind of works better with all three?
I think this is the Achilles heel of this movie. I think this is its fatal flaw. I think that it's a really cute gimmick. And actually, I think if they would have edited the movie the way they edited the home video, it would have been great. It would have been so much better. But like you said in the intro, they tried to do it as a gimmick where paying theater goers only got to see one of the three endings. And the endings are not equally good, right?
No, they're not. Yeah, they're definitely tears to them.
So how would you feel if you paid your $7.50 or whatever it cost for a movie back in the day and you only saw ending A? And you're like, is Miss Peacock? But I didn't even care about Peak, like, she didn't say that many things. And why was that the movie, you know? And then to find out that, oh, if you want to see the better one, you got to come up with more money and go back and you got to go to a different theater. So I think if they alternated it in the same place might be one thing. But I think in reality, they didn't roll it out that way. They just gave different theaters different cuts. And there was a little A, B, and C that they would put in the movie listings in the newspaper. So you could see.
Oh, right. Yeah, you could see theater had some newspapers would publish which ending was going to be. Because, I mean, that's how you used to find out movie time. Right?
Yeah, I remember that paging through the newspaper.
So, yeah, that's obnoxious. You know, there's not many movies I've seen three times in theaters, no matter how much I like them.
Yeah, let alone how many people live in a dense enough area that there's three theaters that they could get to that would carry the same movie.
Right. We both grew up in major cities on the coast, so we probably could have managed it. But
we could have found them. But yeah, it was just they got too wrapped up in this idea. And then they figured it out for home video. And that's the movie on home video is just a much better movie. Because for me, only ending C where everyone is guilty is enough payoff to make the movie feel worthwhile. And
that's the ending. Yeah. That's the one that it should be considered canon, in my opinion. Not even because the filmmakers have said so, literally with the title card, just because of the way it kind of ties up the story. It's the most satisfying.
Yeah, it's satisfying. It's the only one that gives you enough payoff. Because if you're just like, oh, it was just Miss Peacock, and then there's a helper, there's more than one person. But even then, that's not enough. You're not invested in any of these characters. So if all of them aren't involved in some really dramatic way at the end, it's not enough payoff for a movie that's basically a puzzle box and you're opening it and you're opening it and you need to basically play all the pieces at the end of the game for it to be rewarding. And I feel bad for the people that saw ending A.
I hope they're not still mad about it all these years later.
Maybe they never knew. I mean, think about it. There's no internet. Like, how did you even find out the difference? Now you go online right away and you can read what the other endings are that you missed if this movie were to happen today. But how would you even know back then? Wait till an article came out in your newspaper, like scour local newspapers for some movie critic who would actually write up the details of the movie. I don't know.
Watch At the Movies with Gene and Roger, hear them talk about it. I don't know. They actually filmed a fourth ending. Can you believe that?
Yeah, that makes it even more crazy if they were ever thinking that like more is better.
Four of these. It was filmed, but never included any cut of the movie. So in the fourth ending, Wadsworth admits that he killed everyone, with a slow-acting poison that he secretly put in their drinks. So the original Mrs. Peacock freakout would have been justified in that case.
Oh, yeah.
He did so out of a sadistic need for perfection in his life. I mean, I don't know if anyone's ever actually seen this ending. I don't think it was ever available as like an extra. Maybe it's more eloquently explained, but that doesn't strike me as enough of a reason to call a bunch of people to a house and slowly poison them to death.
And kind of a letdown when you have six different Chekhov's guns in the first act. One of them is an actual gun and five other weapons. And then you go, oh, actually none of them were used in this movie.
It's poison.
Yeah, it's poison the whole time.
The laziest shit ever. So then Wadsworth is leaving the house after this and is confronted by the police chief, but then the guard dogs actually kill him when he tries to get in his car.
Oh, that's the freak ending? That's the number four?
That's the number four, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Which I guess pays off his, I don't know who let them off the chain. Oh, or maybe it's okay. The Dobermans, the other dogs that we haven't seen. Because there's just attack dogs roaming this property, as we've learned.
Yeah, of course.
In the greenhouse scene.
So there's a whole circle of life thing in the end, the final scene. I don't know, that sounds gruesome.
It's a little dark, right?
I get them trying other things.
Yeah.
But I'm glad they at least left that one. On the cutting
well, it seemed
floor.
Like maybe they found the tone of the movie in the edit more, because also in Mrs. Peacock's original ending, where she's the villain, she is shot to death by the chief of police. And then they recut it where she's taken away. They have like her shout something off screen about, you can't arrest me, I'm a senator's wife. But then the chief's gun is still smoking in the next scene. So there's still some remnants of that ending.
Yeah, I guess I felt like someone was shot to death in all of the ones. Because in the ending C, the big finale, they let Michael McKean shoot Wadsworth to death in the hallway and just celebrate it, which was to me was kind of dark. But
basically
played,
stands over him. Yeah, fuck you.
Yeah, and then they do gotcha, a high stupid. Five freeze frame 80s action cop show ending.
Yeah, that was strange.
It's silly. The movie gets real silly in parts.
It does get silly, but it worked, man. I love it. So the Carrie Fisher thing is tough to talk about because she obviously had to drop out of the movie because of substance abuse problems, but she was cast as Miss Scarlet and was on board to film, but she ended up going to rehab 4 days before filming was ready to start. So that's not a lot of time. She called up Jonathan Lynn, the director, and she got approval from rehab for a work furlough. So if she got approval from, you know, the people handling her care, she could leave to go film. But the production company's insurance would not approve this.
Wow.
Wouldn't insure her or the production if they went through with this plan. So she had to drop out of the project. And Leslie Ann Warren was, like we mentioned in the monologue, married to one of the producers. So she was kind of brought on last minute and did great, by the way. She puts in a great performance.
Leslie Ann Warren is really good in this. She's strong. She really fills that role admirably. It would have been really fun to see Carrie Fisher in a movie like this.
For as funny as she obviously is, and she's known as one of the quickest witted people in Hollywood, her movie career isn't as comedic as it could have been, I feel like. And for her to have, you know, a really funny role in a high profile comedy like this, first of all, I think the movie probably does better with her name attached to it, because she's coming off the Star Wars franchise at this point. That's still pretty fresh. So that would be a boon to the box office of the movie. And just, I think it would have been a great performance to see, but can't complain about Leslie Ann Warren at all. She brings the goods in this movie.
Yeah, she's great.
She talks at length in an interview about this movie about how uncomfortable she was wearing a corset
for
the entire filming of it. And she basically had to be like, she had to like just stand in the corner in between because she couldn't really sit down or stand up without assistance.
Geez.
Sounds pretty brutal.
I did notice that she was in a very tight dress, and forgive me for noticing that, but they make it very visible in this movie. I didn't know she went through so much suffering for her art.
We appreciate it. I don't know if it was 100% necessary, but certainly whatever. We're not the filmmakers. Don't blame us.
Yeah, don't blame us for anything on this podcast.
Tim Curry considers this, it's his favorite movie that he ever made.
Oh, really?
So that could be another reason why it got such a big following, because people love Tim Curry. Tim Curry loves this movie. You know, by the transitive property, everyone loves Blue.
It makes sense.
I don't know a lot about the transitive property. I hope that's
correct. That totally checks out based on my science education.
Sweet.
Yeah, not Muppet Treasure Island or any of the other really fun, kooky things he was in.
Not Legend. Legend must have been a nightmare. I can't imagine sitting for the makeup in that movie.
Oh, my God.
He's unrecognizable in that movie.
Yeah.
It's. I think that movie kind of bombed, too, didn't it?
I don't know. It's super weird. If it bombed, we got to do it.
Oh, it did. Cool. Holy shit. $25 million budget, $23 million box office.
Oh, man. Shortlist that, baby. We are doing Legend, people. Get ready.
Tom Cruise, Mia Sara. God, I forgot what a good cast this has. So let's talk about when the movie was released, what it was going up against. It only opened to $2 million its opening weekend, good for sixth place. Not what you want out of your $15 million star-studded comedy, $2 million opening weekend.
No, that's pretty sad.
Rocky IV was in its third week and won the weekend with $7.2 million.
Okay.
So Rocky IV, pretty big mountain to climb.
Yeah, for sure.
Pun intended, because he goes to Siberia and climbs a mountain.
Oh, that's the one where he's got the log on his shoulders and he's running in the snow?
That's the one. Cold War, the movie. But boxing. And the only other new movie that came out that week was The Jewel of the Nile, which made $6.6 million that weekend, but would go on to have legs. It ended up making almost $100 million with a $25 million budget. So that was a hit. Between Rocky IV and Jewel of the Nile, I guess I could see that taking away a lot of clues. Audience, and the reviews weren't great at first. Obviously, it's been reevaluated critically since, but critics didn't love this movie. Some of the more notable critics at the time, like Roger Ebert, were pretty down on it.
Yeah, I mean, Roger came to the same conclusion I did, which was like, just show the three endings. Why did you do that?
Yeah, it does feel like that garnered a lot of bad will towards the movie. And rightfully so. Like we said, how many fucking movies do you see three times in the theater? I've done it, but not often.
Yeah, that's too much hubris. Nobody has that much balls to think that their movie is so good, we're going to gamble everything on that everyone who sees it is going to want to triple dip.
I mean, I could see them foreseeing this being a midnight movie like Rocky Horror, where maybe people show up and see it and it's something like a fun thing. Like, oh, which ending are we going to see for this one? You know, but it wasn't in the cards. Didn't go that way. Became a staple of home video. And I'd like to see this in a theater if there ever is like an indie theater that is playing old movies. Seeing Clue in a theater would probably be a blast, but I want to see all three endings.
Yeah, you don't want an original cut. You want this home video style where you don't miss a thing.
Absolutely. I don't think this movie really hurt anyone's career too badly, actually. Obviously, most of the actors you talked about are still notable people that went on to have great careers. Let's talk about Jonathan Lynn a little bit. This was his first theatrical movie. So you kind of wonder how he got picked for this job, right? He ended up writing it and directing it. I don't really know where his name came from. He had directed TV movies up until this point.
Okay.
Arms and the Man was his only directorial credit at this point, and that was a direct TV movie.
Okay.
So sadly, there's just not a lot of info about the early production of this movie out there where I could find out why him. What was it about him that attracted John Landis to throw his weight behind him for this? But after this, it didn't stop his career at all. He continued to work. He made a movie called Nuns on the Run, which I can only imagine based on its title is quality. Then he made My Cousin Vinny, obviously a classic and a pretty big hit.
Yeah. Between that and this, that kind of cements your career, no matter whatever other bombs you're about to tell us he made. Kind of can't take the guy down.
My Cousin Vinny got some Oscar noms, didn't it?
Yeah.
Marissa Tomei won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress.
Did she win that? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, she did. So good for her. Love Marissa Tomei. Still kicking it. Still going strong. And then he made Sergeant Bilko, that Steve Martin movie. That was a bomb. The Distinguished Gentleman, which is an Eddie Murphy movie that I've somehow never heard of. You know, you feel like an Eddie Murphy movie coming out was a pretty big deal. You'd probably at least heard of it, even if you didn't see it.
Hard to miss, yeah.
But no, I have no knowledge of this movie, but it bombed. So Greedy, which was a bomb. Trial and Error, which was a bomb. The Whole Nine Yards, which is a movie people like and did okay. But then they made The Whole 10 Yards, which was the sequel, which bombed horribly and is also like one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, really? I skipped those somehow. That's Matthew Perry and Bruce Willis action.
Yeah, The Whole Nine, it's like an action comedy. Matthew Perry plays a dentist, gets caught up with a hitman. Okay. The Whole Nine Yards is not bad from what I remember, but again, I haven't seen it in a long time. But yeah, The Whole 10 Yards is like a all-time bad movie, and not like a so bad it's good movie, just a so bad it's bad movie. But we'll probably cover that at some point too. It's on the list.
You might have to do it.
The Fighting Temptations, which got good reviews but didn't make any money. And then his final movie was Wild Target, which got bad reviews and was also a bomb. He's not dead or anything. He's just retired. So that was his final movie. So Jonathan Lynn, pretty distinguished comedy career when you factor in My Cousin Vinny and Clue, but more misses than hits overall in his career. But he kept getting chances. He kept making movies. You know, I think that's a solid career for a director if you get to make 8 to 12 movies.
I mean, we venerate the directors who don't miss, and those are the really special ones, and they're rare. But you can really work in Hollywood if you make a couple really strong movies, and then you might miss a lot.
I feel like you got more chances back then, too. For whatever reason, there were just more movies being made, I guess. There have been rumors about a new Clue movie. Have you heard about
it? No. Tell me. Is it going
to
happen?
I don't think so. If I had to put money on it, I'd say no. Oh. But it seemed like it was going to happen. In 2018, Fox announced that Ryan Reynolds was going to star in a new Clue remake. Jason Bateman was going to direct it and star in it with Reynolds.
Wow.
These two have been in movies together already. The Switch Up or something like that. It was a bomb. It was a comedy about two dudes switching bodies.
I could see them in contemporary stuff, but it would have been fun to have them in a somewhat period, somewhat stylized genre movie together.
Absolutely. Yeah, Deadpool writers Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick were going to write the screenplay. Bateman left the movie, probably just because it was not really moving along. And then the last update we got was that Dora and the Lost City of Gold director James Bobin was in talks to direct it, but there's been no news on it in a couple of years. So who knows if it's a COVID casualty or if it was just some other stuff going on. But I don't know. Ryan Reynolds, not a Wadsworth, maybe a Mr. Body. I could see that.
Maybe. They would have to do a lot with the script, do something to reinvent it. I mean, you hope.
Right. You hope they're not just doing a scene by scene retread.
It's a decent enough property that it may be dead for now, but it will probably lie dormant and it has a chance because it's not timely in its content. It could be resurrected at any moment in the future.
And like Knives Out and Murder on the Orient Express and the upcoming Murder on the Nile, I think is what it's called.
Death
but, you
Nile.
Know, murder mysteries are kind of back in now. They're in vogue a little bit again. Knives Out is getting two sequels. Game Night kind of played off. I think had a big Clue influence. And that's a fun movie and was also a big hit. So it seems like people are hungry for these type of movies again.
Yeah, that's fun to see that come around. That's a thing we don't think about when we talk about genre movies dominating. Obviously, the superhero movies have owned the last decade or so. But people don't think about murder mysteries and whodunits as being a genre that could come back as being a thing.
But it's kind of happening.
Yeah, by the force of will of Rian Johnson, plus his heart.
And Daniel Craig's horrible Southern accent.
It's adjacent to our heist movies, which is a major subgenre that's stayed popular in Hollywood. And so I think people can get some of the same fun mystery solving action out of it, but with a slightly different genre.
And they're probably not crazy expensive to make. Most of them take place in just a couple locations. So that makes it a little bit more economical and you can kind of spend some money on the cast and get like a really fun group of actors in there.
Exactly. And I was going to say, everyone loves that. I love that. I feel like that's a thing that people love.
Yeah, absolutely. So that kind of wraps up everything I had on Clue. Did you want to bring us a Ian final thoughts on the movie, eloquently sum up our whole experience?
You know what? No promises, no expectations, but I do have something that I thought I would say, which is just don't do this. Don't do a gimmick when you're releasing a theatrical movie that holds stuff back from the audience. The best thing that you made, give it to them. Don't hold on to it. On streaming, you could get away with alternate endings and that would be fun. And people could go, oh, it's no more cost and effort for me to discover the multiple endings. In the theaters, that was just a non-starter. And even though the 80s was a ripe time, I could see why they wanted to make this movie. I remember back to my youth, Hercule Poirot movies were a big thing. Peter Ustinov was starring in big movies as Poirot. It was an Agatha Christie era. BBC had these Miss Marples that they kept putting out. And then this movie, I think, draws a lot from Murder by Death, which was not a bomb, was actually a big moneymaker and was very similar in tone and style. A big ensemble cast, spoof of the whodunit genre. It had much more specific stuff. It was parodying all these famous detectives. But you could see studios looking at that and going, well, that was a big hit. Let's make Clue. It's the same thing. But that movie achieved something that Clue didn't quite get to. It had more star power. It had Neil Simon writing it. It was on a slightly more elevated level in terms of the comedy power and the screenwriting. So yeah, this movie just didn't have enough juice to overcome the handicap that it gave itself. I'd still, going back in the time machine, wonder what could have happened if they would have released a three-ending version. Maybe we wouldn't be getting to talk about it today.
It's tough to say what the reception to this whole gimmick was at the time because there's just not a lot out there. The critic reviews, even the positive reviews, seem down on the concept of the three separate endings being played randomly in different theaters. So I wonder how much there was just a lack of goodwill towards this whole movie because of that concept. And maybe that hamstrung it because the movie itself is delightful and it's fun. And there's not a lot of better ways to spend 94 minutes, in my opinion. So is John Landis to blame here for this harebrained idea of releasing these three separate endings in theaters and kind of fucking up his own movie? I think so. You know, what's not to like about this movie? I'm trying to put myself in the mind of a moviegoer in 1985. And why am I not spending my $7 or whatever to go see this movie? And that's the best I can come up with. First of all, Rocky IV is out in theaters, which is just a masterpiece. And then
you don't want to go toe to toe with Rocky IV.
Not at all.
It will crush you.
It will break you.
Oh, break you. Sorry, man. My old brain.
If Clue dies, it dies. But that had to factor in. Every review I've read from that era mentions it. So it's not like it was a non-issue at the time or people weren't aware of it. If you did any research before going to the movies, you knew this was a thing this movie was going to throw at you. And, you know, marketing for the movie, how heavy was the three separate endings included in the marketing for the movie too? I fucked up. I didn't look at trailers before I recorded this episode. I wonder, does it come up in the trailer as well?
I looked at the trailer and I don't think it came up, but if it did, I will put a note in the edit that will embarrass me right now.
Note, the multiple endings did not come up in the trailer, but we found a TV commercial where they used it as a selling point. Check the show notes.
Okay. It does seem like there was a fair amount of backlash to that whole concept that maybe rubbed people the wrong way and disincentivized them to go see the movie, which is the opposite of what you want to do. You want to give them reasons they should go, pay their money. And yeah, this movie fumbled the ball at the 1 yard line. You made a great movie with a great cast, a property people recognize and was popular at the time, and then you just threw one too many things on it with this little gimmick and you fucked it up. But the content of the movie itself and getting to watch it with all three endings intact, I could not be happier. There's very few movies we've covered for the podcast that I was more excited to go back and rewatch. So I had a lot of fun with this one. I hope you guys had fun listening.
I hope so too.
So that was Clue. Please tune in next week. Remember to rate, review, subscribe to the pod. Send us a suggestion, a question, whatever. We are on Twitter, BlastZonePod. We have an email address, BlastZonePod@gmail.com. We are always happy to hear from you, and we will see you next week in the Blast Zone.
See you next time in the Blast Zone.
The Blast Zone.